bubbly beep bop, mama. Bubbly beep bop, bubbly beep. Make way for the reaper.
All right, welcome to Between Bites with Nina Compton, me, Larry Miller. This one, we're excited for, folks. You've waited almost two-thirds of the way through the season for us to sit down with CJ McCollum.
Welcome.
I appreciate you guys having me. It's a pleasure to be on here.
Now, we could talk about basketball if we wanted to, but we're not going to because you have a whole lot of other things going on in your life. One thing that personally I needed to ask you, you have a brother who's 3 years older than you. Mm-hmm. I'm 3 years older than my little brother.
Gotcha.
Does he still beat you in everything he does?
Almost everything.
Okay.
He's smarter. He's more experienced. I would say he's more explosive as a basketball player than I am. In terms of investing, he's taught me everything. He taught me how to walk. He taught me how to cook. Him alongside my mom potty trained me. I basically watched him and learned how to do those types of things. But without him, there is no good version of me, and I tell him that all the time. So I'm thankful for him and the leadership and maturity that he displayed in our upbringing. And he used to always tell me, take advantage of the path that he's taking and learn from his mistakes. And I got to watch, you know, a great example of do's and don'ts, mm-hmm. mostly do's on how to be successful. And without him, I don't play basketball. I don't become good at basketball. I don't think that I can become a professional athlete, and I don't have any businesses because I wouldn't have thought the way that I needed to think. So I say always to say that he beats me at everything, historically. And he beat me in basketball until I was about 22 years old.
Really?
So
wow.
He was still beating me in one-on-one when I was in the NBA. In fact, full disclosure, he actually won the last time we played, which was last year. So he's very good still. And he used to joke, you'll be ready for the NBA when you can beat me.
That's awesome.
And sure enough, when I beat him, I went to the NBA.
But growing up, it had to be pretty cool. Now, and again, I'm looking back on my basketball career did not last quite as long as yours has. Or your brother's still playing. But my brother played varsity in the ninth grade, just like you did, mm-hmm. playing with you. How cool was that for you to be playing on the same team finally with your big brother?
Yeah, that was one of the coolest experiences of my basketball life. Obviously, I've played in the NBA. I've hit big shots. I've played in college in the NCAA tournament. But playing alongside him, like my idol, the guy who rebounded for me, the guy who pushed me to get up at 6 a.m. and work out, being able to like pass him the ball or receive the ball from him and practice together, it was a cool time in our lives, and one that we didn't understand the magnitude of at the time. But
right.
Looking back, it was like, wow, that was probably the only time, you know, that we'll play together, unless it's a summer league game or unless he plays in the NBA or I end up going overseas later on. We won't ever be able to play in that setting again.
Wow, that's incredible. Does he still critique you when you play?
Yeah, we watch most of each other's games. Obviously, there's a huge time difference with him being in southern Turkey, but mm-hmm. We watch a lot of our games. Historically, Coach probably is going to hear this, but I text my brother at halftime. I've been texting at halftime of games since I was in high school, and I usually text my wife, my mom, and my brother. And generally, he'll respond. It'll be 4 or 5 a.m., and he'll respond, or he'll be sending me like what he's seeing during the game. He sends me clips. And it's cool now because his son, who's 2, knows me. Like, mm-hmm. he recognizes me now, and he's like, I'm going to work out with Uncle C.
Yeah. Oh, so that's so sweet.
Yeah, it's really cool to see.
So do you go to Turkey to see him?
I haven't been since pre-COVID. So I used to go every summer to visit him, no matter where he played at, and then COVID happened, so mm-hmm. I didn't travel. I haven't left the country since 2020 was the last time I left the country. So we'll see what happens with the schedule. We'll see what happens with where life takes us. But I enjoy traveling throughout Europe and getting out there. And at some point, whether it's this year or next year, I'll get out there to see him and take my son and my family as well.
Eat some good food.
Exactly.
Well, one of the things we're excited to talk to you about also is your winery. And congratulations has grown and grown. And then now we have a big project. Your wife Elise have a big project out there, 300 acres in Oregon. Tell us a little bit about McCollum Heritage 91.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you asking. You talk about busy times of the year. We just planted 17 and a half acres last week. Well, prepped it and ended up finishing it last week. We planted 7 acres of Pommard 2 years ago, so we're on second leaf now. I'm losing track of the time as I go through the process, but it's been a really cool educational experience for me as a basketball player, as a person who is an expert in basketball. I'm not an expert in wine at all, so learning, asking questions, and always being strategic about how thoughtful the process is, how meticulous it is, and how a lot of it is out of your control in terms of weather. Luckily, we were able to get our vines and everything in the ground. Hopefully we don't have a snow or frost, if you will, after Mother's Day. We were on calls today. Before I came here, I was just talking about the property, the projects that we have lined up, our planning schedule, understanding, you know, what the next 3 to 5 years are going to look like, what percentage of grapes do we sell, what percentage of fruit do we keep, what's the taste profile we're going for, all that stuff. So we were going through that. And then in the meantime, you talked about McCollum Heritage 91, which is the current venture in partnership with Adelsheim, going through our run of show, figuring out our next release date, which is going to be a rosé. We'll figure out the exact date of that, figuring out when we want to release our next Chardonnay, understanding that we lost our 2020 grapes of Pinot Noir. We'll be releasing multiple Pinot Noirs this year. I don't think anybody knows this yet, but we'll do a blend and we'll do a single vineyard. I'll probably get in trouble for saying this before it happens, but it's been a really cool process to where people were able to get more familiar with my family and I's journey in the wine space, not just in the business, but actually drinking wine and becoming more appreciative of the process in which my wine is made.
What made you get into wine and do this venture?
I ask myself that a lot now as I go through the process. But my wife introduced me to wine. We were 21, of course. Yes, in college. And I wasn't a big fan of it. You know, I drink lemonade, orange juice, and the stronger stuff historically. And as I became more curious and in pursuit of her, I ended up getting drafted to the Portland Trailblazers. That introduces me to the Willamette Valley. That introduces me to Volcanic Soil. I taste Walter Scott's wine made by Ken and Erica. And I begin to dive down the hole of, wow, this is really cool. Mm-hmm. How is this made? So I start going to visiting sites, tasting with somms, barrel tasting, and then understanding and appreciating the process of different fruits, what they taste like, the direction that it should be planted, how much precipitation matters, California versus Oregon. It took me down the loophole of just becoming obsessed with the process, but also the peace and tranquility that I received when I was at vineyards. Mm-hmm. I thought to myself, as a black man who grew up in Canton, Ohio, this is a really cool experience that I wish more of our people could enjoy and be comfortable in. And next thing you know, I'm learning more and I'm beginning a partnership with Adelsheim on education and wine.
I love that. It's so great to see, because we met the first time in Aspen last year, where yourself and Dwayne Wade did that dinner, and we tasted your wine all through the weekend, and it was lovely. It was just a great weekend to see a lot more diversity in that group of people, and I think that this year is going to be the same thing. So I think that once we start opening up more spaces like that, more people will join in, because you have the McBride sisters that also make wine as well. So you're seeing a lot more people, you know, dabble into that stuff. So it's great to see.
How many of those wine festivals, well, I mean, you get invited to all of them, I'm guessing, but how many are you able to attend?
We've been very strategic as of late in terms of involvement, figuring out scheduling, also the balance of all the things that I'm doing outside of wine and basketball. And this year, we're excited about the calendar. I was just going through my calendar, my summer calendar. Food and Wine in Aspen in June. Essence Festival, we'll be at that. Food and Wine in New Orleans, we'll have a presence there. I actually have a wedding that I have to attend, but we'll have a presence there. Ashley will be representing us, and we'll be a part of some of the events that'll go on there. IPNC, International Pinot Noir Conference in Oregon, will be one of the featured wines there. So we'll be a part of that process, and we'll be pouring one of our blends from McCollum Heritage 91. We'll pour some of our single vineyard that hasn't released yet, and we'll release in 2024. What else is on the schedule? I'm forgetting something. I think we'll have a presence at the family reunion. So that's one, 1, 2, 3, 4.
That's a lot for the summertime.
Yeah, that's basically it. That
don't forget to work out in between.
Yeah. It takes me to September. Yeah, those are just weekends. So my schedule is 6 days a week, generally speaking. Once I'm in phase three of my ramp, 2-a-days, but I do a flex. So Sunday is a day off. Mm-hmm. And even if I do a festival, let's say the festival is Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I'm working out. I travel. Someone travels with me. So I'm still getting my lifts in. I think it's funny because people see me and they're like, you do so much. And I'm like, if you understood how strategic these days were planned out in terms of conference calls on the table, mm-hmm. like I'm still getting treatment, I'm still getting my lifts in. If you get up earlier, like 6 a.m., 5 a.m., and then you still work out at night, you have a full 24 hours or 18 hours to utilize.
Throw a one-year-old into the mix, just over one-year-old.
Yeah, 14 months, the pride and joy of our house. And that's created more discipline, structure, and focus, I would say, but then also the importance of time.
Mm-hmm. Does he have a favorite varietal yet? Dip in the pacifier?
He loves mommy's golden milk. He's a huge fan of that. He's just transferred over the whole milk. He also loves that. Not a big fan of water. Okay. He hasn't had juice yet. I'll slowly maybe slip some juice in when mommy's not looking. But he eats everything, generally speaking, loves oranges, loves guacamole, loves to play with it, and just got his first pasta exposure a couple weeks ago where some noodles ended up on the floor.
That's great. So now that you are living here in New Orleans, and I know that you're very busy, where have you, what are your favorite things to do if you have a moment of spare time?
Yeah, so actually, the restaurant we're currently sitting at is on our list of restaurants to eat at. And if it wasn't my son's nap time, we'd be eating here tonight. But we have a list of restaurants that were recommended to us. Obviously, we've eaten at Bywater. So thank you for that. You guys kept it open for us after a game, and we were extremely late to our reservation.
Actually, that's a great story to tell. That everybody in New Orleans loves you, and we're happy you're here for just over a year as well. CJ had a reservation. We had a 6 o'clock game that night. I keep saying we, like I played for the
Pelicans.
But the Pels had a 6 o'clock game. You had a 9:30 reservation. And we were watching the game, of course. And we saw the game was running a little late. And we kept telling everybody, all right, CJ's going to be a little late. He's not going to make 9:30, but he'll be here. And you guys called on the way to say, sorry you were running late. And we said, it's okay, you know, come on in, we're waiting for you, we're going to serve you. And then you showed up at 5 minutes after 10, it was you and your wife, and you said, we're not going to keep you guys here to eat, we just want to stop by and say thanks for staying open. And of course, we wouldn't accept that answer from you or for any of the guests, that we were ready for you, and you came in and ate. But that is one of the nicest things anybody in the world has ever done with the reservation. And again, it's one of those things that sometimes people get confused with restaurants saying, oh, we close at 10. No, the last seating's at 10 and we're there for you. And especially that we love having the chance to feed y'all, and we love y'all as members of our community. So, but it was incredibly gracious of y'all just to stop
to
by.
Call, yeah.
No, to stop by the restaurant and say, we won't keep y'all, but we just want to apologize. That was awesome. That was really.
No, I apologize because I get treatment after games. So my schedule is like a treatment before I go to the game, play the game, I get treatment afterwards. I might lift, I take a shower. So I didn't lift, I just got treatment, a shower. I looked at my wife, I said, we're going to be late, but first of all, we understand the importance of time, and we never want to keep people past certain times. We're in the industry to serve, and I'm in the serving industry as an athlete, so I understand that. Sometimes things are out of your control, but I just wanted to stop by and say, like, thanks for the reservation. Like, we'll come back. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we don't want to keep you guys, you know, longer than the allotted time. We know you've had a long day, and as a working man, I understand it. And my wife and I are always big on hospitality, treating people the way you want to be treated. Like, if it was my restaurant, how would I feel?
Right.
You know, how would I feel as a worker in the restaurant? So we just felt like that was the right thing to do. And we were like, we really don't have to eat here. Like, we'll go, we'll figure it out. And you guys are gracious enough to serve us in. We stay for dessert as well. And
yeah, it was our pleasure.
I truly appreciate it.
I interrupted the question about the rest of the restaurants. So.
But yes, so I have a list. I can read them to you if you guys would like. But we try to do one a week. We try to do date night because obviously the world is a hectic place. Mm-hmm. And if you have two working people in a household where spouse works, husband works, or wife works, it becomes very difficult. You had a kid, you had a schedule where you're traveling, you had a dog, and sometimes you lose yourself. So we try to have a lot of time for each other, whether that's an hour, 90 minutes, 2 hours, whether that's watching TV, refreshing, and we go to dinner. So that's really helpful for us. In our spare time, we like to go on walks. I'm just a really simple person in terms of things that make me happy. I like good weather, and I like good food, and I have that here.
I agree with that. Yeah. I agree.
So that's like, outside of that, we haven't really done much. I said we went to a music class today with my son, his first one, which is really cool. Honestly, I play basketball. I run some businesses. I take conference calls to try to learn on the fly. I listen to podcasts. And I enjoy nice walks when it's 40 degrees like it is today, or when it's like 75.
Yeah.
Above that, I gotta wait till the sun
sets. Above that, you go back to Portland. Where was I gonna go with that? We can edit out some. Okay, so now I don't want to say you're an old head, but you're a veteran in the NBA. As you are growing up in that, or as you are developing as a basketball player and a guy that people are now looking up to, the younger guys coming into the league, you jump into a business that you're fascinated with, but for lack of a better word, you're a rookie winery. How do you see, are there synergies there where you see guys looking up to you in the league as you look up to some of the people you worked with at Adelsheim or with Gina making some of the wines early on?
Absolutely. I think it's all about paying your dues. Done the same thing in the sports world where you're learning, you're asking questions, not afraid to not know, right? Like, I think that's always been my thing, right? I don't know everything about basketball, but I can teach you a lot. I can show you a lot. I'm an expert in that realm, and I like to rely on experts and people that care about wine the way that I do in the wine world. And that's from the educational standpoint to learning, to studying, to watching how they move in the wine space, what type of wines are they putting out, how are they releasing them. I love checking out people's clubs. I love going to wine dinners to see exactly how things are being done different ways. Obviously, there's a lot of ways to get things done, but from an efficiency standpoint, I think it's really helped me in terms of understanding that, like, this is something that I'm becoming more comfortable in, but there are a lot of people who have been doing it a lot longer than me, and I can learn a lot from them, and I think I've taken that approach. And one of the things we've talked about alongside Ashley and some of our wine advisors is the importance of education. So now we're working on an education plan where we have fixed learnings, whether that's tasting, whether that's learning regions, whether that's learning more about the business. Obviously, in partnership with Adelsheim, continue to utilize those resources in their 7 years of experience plus in the space. And then there's the actual WSET, and then figuring out ways to, like, the same way that I know basketball, trying to get to that point in wine. And that's going to take years and years of dedication and sacrifice. But 1 week at a time, you know, a few hours a day or whatever the case may be, as we continue to progress, will be very helpful for not only the business, but for my understanding of what I want to accomplish.
And do you get, I know climate change is a very big part of the wine business right now. And do you, you know, what have your advisors given you as information?
They said this is a very interesting field for you to join, CJ. understanding that the running joke in the wine space is if you want to make $1 million, you spend 10. Mm-hmm. And not quite accurate, but close. I would say that in the conversations I've had, climate change is a huge issue. Continuing to figure out ways to make sure people are treating the world the way that they should is important, not only for our business, but for our kids and for what comes next for humanity. And that you're rolling the dice a lot of times. You know, like I said before we started recording, we're hoping that we don't get frost in May. We're hoping that there aren't any more fires. We're hoping that temperatures continue to regulate and that we continue to see more normalcy in our weather. I have the weather app available. I'm always checking on Oregon, specifically Carlton and the Willamette Valley, to see what it's looking like. I know it's been the 40s or 50s, which is pretty status quo. Mm-hmm. We haven't had as much rain as we normally would have, which could be good or could be bad. But in regards to the wine business, once the vines are in the ground, you got first leaf, you got second leaf, you got third leaf, you got a good chance to preserve in the event of something unforeseen occurring. But it feels like lately I've been getting the, yeah, this is the first time in 50 years. And I'm like, why is this happening now?
Is it me?
And the same thing goes for us being in the nursery business. It's like our you know, now we have greenhouses and we got heaters. And so we don't have to worry about anything outside of the greenhouses. But we have our mother tree that's exposed to whatever weather comes.
Yeah.
And we had a first time in 70-year occurrence last year where we ended up losing some of our seedlings, which took away some of our production on our Japanese maple leaves. But so did Asia. So did California. And everywhere else you would get Japanese maple leaves. So that was the first time in, you know, call it 100 years where everybody was struggling and missing the same thing as opposed to being able to go and get the resource. So I say all this to say that it's a gamble, if you will. It's a passion project that will become a legacy project for generations to come after us. But at the very least, I think this is a space in which my family and I will be able to leave it better than it was when we found it in our own right. And I think that speaks to what we're trying to accomplish in this space while providing great service, while providing tremendous wine, education, and comfortability for the masses, especially people that come from places like we come from.
Oh, Larry wants to ask, but I'm going to ask the question. Who orders the wine at dinner?
Ah, man. I order, but I ask. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So Elise will probably pass me the wine list, and she'll say, you order, and then I say, well, what do you want? What region? Do you want bubbles or do you not want bubbles? What do you want to start with? Would you like to start with a cocktail and then kind of progress our way to a white wine? And then we kind of go from there. And I will say she loves Super Tuscany. She loves Sassicaia a lot. She loves smooth, soft Pinots. Whenever there's an Oregon wine, we're looking into it, trying to figure out, all right, what years do you have? If it's a 19, we're like, do you have any 16s? Do you have any 15s? Yeah. And they're like, well, you want to go back into the library? I'm like, we would love to go into the library. And that's kind of generally how we've done it historically. But I always ask, like, what are you in the mood for? And sometimes she says, surprise me. But usually she's like,
that's what I do to Larry, too. Because I'll give him the one that might just choose for me and surprise me. But he still asks, just like you.
Smart.
Yeah. So you don't have enough on your plate, and a couple years ago you're elected president of the Players Association. You talk about time and organizing your time, and it boggles my mind how you're able to balance all that, because that's a bit. You could not play and be the president of the Players Association, full-time. And it's a full-time job.
Yeah.
How heavy is that responsibility?
It's heavy. It's very heavy. I think. I say this all the time, I thrive in chaos. So I'm very good at doing a lot of things and still maintaining sanity, peace, tranquility. I found a better balance of how to do it structurally, from a time management standpoint to getting up earlier to allotting family time. These are times I'm unavailable for all these jobs. These are the times where my job is to be dad, husband. And then there's times where I'm not balancing them quite as well as I would like, but there's seasons of change and you figure out how to adjust and recalibrate. But I would say that this is the most difficult time because we're making a playoff push, right? I'm battling an injury. My son's transitioning to maybe walking. So you think about all these things and it's like, oh, I'm negotiating the CBA right now, building out a wine business. So you're doing all these things while trying to play at a high level. And I think the important part is never losing focus of the main thing. The main thing is I have a job at home, right? And I have to be a star in my role at home for my family to move and revolve how it's supposed to around this earth and this world. I have a role in my team that I have to do to the best of my ability. So I dedicate all my time to my household and my team. And then I do the other stuff. So the rest of the stuff is scheduled around that. The calls I may have for CBA. I also work for ESPN. So the things I may have to do for ESPN revolves around my household and my basketball schedule. So I think that kind of created a better order for me. I have a therapist, which also helps create order and clear some of the confusion or just clarity on, am I doing this right? Should I be thinking about it this way? And then I think the sounding board you have in your household is important. So before I do all of these things, I speak to my wife, like, what do you think about this? This is what this commitment means for me. This is what it means for us. These are the things I'll be able to be a part of in our household. These are things I may miss. How do you feel about that? Understanding that this is a commitment, that some of these commitments are lifelong unless we sell. Some of these commitments are seasonal, where it's heavier this point of the year, it's lighter here, 2 years, 3 years, 1 year, whatever the case may be. So that's helped. My most peaceful moments are on my walks, changing diapers with my wife, and during games. So all these things could be going on, but when I get to show up to the arena for a game, people may feel like it's pressure. It's an escape. Mm. It's the fun that I've had my whole life. It's what I've used to get through the environments I grew up in, the pressure of going to school, the pressure of getting a scholarship, the pressure of just being a young black male in inner city with the distractions and disruptions that a lot of times can steer you in the wrong direction. Basketball has always been my safe haven. So I always know that I can do that at a high level because I love it, I care, and I prepare. And the rest of the stuff has the same approach. If I love it, I'll do it. If I don't, I'll leave it. And that helps me be successful or become more successful in structuring days, time, and commitments. And people around me will argue, sometimes I take on too much, and I agree. Now I'm finding the balance that I can be great, but efficient and happy. And I want to be great, efficient, and miserable. So yeah. Figuring out that balance has been very important for me.
That's a beautiful way to see it.
When did you, everybody dreams playing in the NBA. You're at Lehigh, you're coming up, you're getting good. When did it hit you, like, I'm gonna play in the league?
So it was always my dream. My parents told me at an early age, we can't afford college. You gotta get really good grades or be really good at sports. You choose. Maybe do both.
I did both.
Later on, I did both. I was really good at sports, and then I got better at getting good grades. But high school, I was short, 5'2", 5'7". I didn't start till I was 5'11", my junior year. And I worked really hard that year going into my junior year. My brother came home. We did 6 a.m.s every day, 2 days, 6 a.m. to 8, break, run the stairs, lift, shoot at night, whole summer. Basically 1,000 shots, 1,000 makes a day. And I started reading more. I understood the importance of the 10,000-hour rule, what that means, how you become an expert at your craft, but also the mental component of what you say becomes your reality. And I began to speak positive things, positive thoughts, yield positive, you know, positive results. I began to speak positively about what I wanted to accomplish and how I was going to do it and how to hold myself accountable. And I said I was going to score 50 points the night before my first game. The day of my first game, I called my dad. He's like, what you going to do tonight? I said, I'm going to get 50. And my career high was 18. But I had worked hard enough to where I should feel that I should score 50. Then I got to go do it. I ended up scoring 54. I broke the school record. Wow. And after that game, I thought to myself, okay, if I really work the way I believe, right, like I want to be in the NBA, how am I going to work to get to the NBA? Then I can achieve anything. And at that moment forward, I said, I'm going to go to the NBA. It doesn't matter where I go to college at because I can go to a small school like some of the guys I've seen and dominate and get to the NBA. So I finished that year. Lehigh sends me a letter 3 days later. I had never heard of Lehigh. They began to recruit me. I end up committing. Later on, I committed to Lehigh at 5'11". I played my senior year out 6'1". I get to campus, I'm 6'3". So my freshman year goes by. I come off the bench first game, second game, third game I start. I break the school record for most points in the first start. And I started every game for the rest of my career. So I would say I thought I was going to the NBA when I was 16, and I broke the school record in my first start. I knew I was going to the NBA my freshman year of college because of how I was progressing, but also how the game was becoming easier. I was getting taller, I was getting a little stronger, and I started to see players that played like me in the NBA, and I was like, okay, if he can make it, Keith McLeod can make it. He's from where I'm from. Antonio Daniels is from, you know, went to Bowling Green. They're 6'3", 6'4". Steph Curry at the time was about to go to the NBA. George Hill was a mid-major guy. I seen it, and I was like, okay, this is the blueprint, follow it, and the rest is history.
Now, that leads to another thing. You're drafted 10th overall, which is kind of a dream coming out, but for 2 years, you didn't play a lot. You had D-League games or G-League, whatever, back then. How did that feel? You were the man, your top 10 people selected that year, but then you're in the league. And then how was that mentally, going from being the man to being part of this team?
Mentally, it was a lot. It was a big adjustment because you go from being big man on campus. My freshman year, I won freshman of the year, player of the year, right? So that was 18 years old doing that. And to go from the high of highs to getting drafted to breaking my foot again to coming back to not playing, 2 foot fractures in less than a year, and you start to question, like, is this for me? Can I do this? Like, the mental hurdles that you begin to face, depression, anxiety, self-doubt, all those things kind of crept in, and you have to make sure you level set with yourself and say, look, this is what I want to accomplish. I'm going to figure out how to do it. I'm not going to make excuses. And I ended up fracturing my finger in my shooting hand my second year, and I was third string shooting guard, third string point guard. The backup gets hurt, the starter gets hurt. I become a starter to end my second year, and I always told myself I wouldn't blow an opportunity by not playing. I blow an opportunity by not being ready when the time comes for me to play, and I was ready. And the rest is history. And obviously,
you came up with that on your own to be ready when that opportunity came up.
Based on circumstance,
because that's pretty mature thought process.
I had help. My mom, my dad, my girlfriend, who's now my wife, like, they all like encouraged me. But my brother, who was already a pro, he was just telling me, like, this is the way of the world. Like, you have to work your way up in the corporate world, everywhere in society. You have to work your way up, and you start at the bottom of the totem pole. And when you get to the top, you remember the struggles at the bottom so that you can better relate, but also better equip yourself to be a leader. So I kind of went through that phase of, okay, I'm starting here just like freshman year of college. I'm carrying the dirty gear. They're sending me on errands. Like, it's just like bringing donuts, you know, in the office space. One day I'm going to be a senior. I got to senior year. So now I'm teaching freshmen how to move, and then it starts over rookie year again. I'm getting the donuts, and I'm making the errands, and I'm making the runs. And I'm now 10 years in, I can say that I didn't necessarily see the vision, like, oh, this is going to turn out great for me. But I'm glad I went through it, because my appreciation of every role has grown to the point where I can tell people, like, look, I didn't play. I know what it's like to not play. I know what it's like to show up to the arena and know you're not going to play. I know what it's like to be injured. I've had 3 foot fractures. I've broken my back. I've had it all. So I know the rehab phase. I know the stress that goes into that. And then I know what it's like to make a lot of money and play every night. So I can relate to you, and I can teach you how to do this the right way.
That's very impressive. And, you know, I think that we look at athletes, you know, 10 years that's a long time, you know. And what advice do you give the young players coming up of, hey, if you do start year one and then you injure yourself and you're done, what do you do?
Yeah, I would say have healthy hobbies, have interests. The most success I've seen in my life is when I have interests outside of my sport. When what you do consumes you to the point of you not being able to do anything else, it becomes problematic. Mm-hmm. And I think I've done all phases of, I can't do anything. I can't go out to eat. I can't talk to family. I have a game, leave me alone, to like finding my balance of, okay, I can do these things. I still need my 30-minute nap or my hour nap, but I have a balance.
Larry loves a nap, by the way.
Thank you for saying that.
No, man. I take naps every day, except for off days. Sometimes I don't.
I get mad at him for taking a nap.
It's part of my performance regimen.
I used to nap, but I don't know.
You have to a lot. Me time. I tell people all the time, self-care is extremely important. And whatever that is for everybody, it's different, right? I like french fries. That's self-care for me. Figuring out, like, okay, I need french fries every 2 weeks, like, makes me happy.
One. That's awesome.
What kind of french fries? Crinkle cut or?
Crinkle cut, steak cut, curly, waffle, sweet potato. I ordered sweet potato and steak cut and ate half and half because I just really wanted french fries. So it's like, I say always to say, I am my best self when I have balance. Mm-hmm. Without balance, it's too much in-house, too much out-of-house. Like, you have to have the balance of in-house, out-of-house, this sport, this business, and it makes my life run how I need it to run.
When y'all go on vacation, I'm assuming that's scheduled in there.
It is. So we have looking at your pictures, we have a two-week allotment of vacation that we are going to use this year.
Y'all take some very nice vacations. Are you working out on vacation? Or are you like...
We get in trouble. I mean,
that cheeseburger right there is a vacation cheeseburger.
I normally schedule vacation during a lot of rest time, so where I'm not supposed to be working out. So gotcha. I don't feel like I have to. So I have like a schedule of phases for my training where I like slowly ramp. I take a vacation in between where I'm supposed to give my joints body a rest so I don't feel eager to. I might do some cardio. We might hike. I'm a vacation guy who likes to do nothing. I like to eat and drink and do nothing. But my wife likes activities and a schedule. So that's the balance of activity schedule versus relaxing versus what do we do? But to answer your question, unless I'm vacationing during a work period, I don't work out. Now, what gets us in trouble is business is the business. And the business continues to evolve and grow with or without you mm-hmm. and your involvement. And as a person who has a lot of control in his businesses in terms of yeses and nos, I need to be available for yeses and nos sometimes. So I might sneak off and answer an email or, hey, I got 5 minutes. I'm at the spot. Like, update me on how things are going. But outside of that, I try to remove myself 72 hours or a week or whatever where I'm still checking emails and reading them, but they know I'm not supposed to be responding. Mm-hmm.
That's fair.
That's another one that goes back to her. This is great. You're like our therapist now. I get naps and she can check emails on vacation. When you decided to pick a major at Lehigh, mm-hmm. you picked a pretty cool one, journalism.
I did.
Did you know that? I mean, we're all 18 and we pick a major at 19, and who knows if we're going to end up doing that. But that's something that you get a day-to-day interaction.
Right.
Do you think that it helped you as you adjusted to media scrutiny, obviously, in your profession?
Absolutely. But I'll give you the background on that. I was a business major. I was going to major or minor in business management and probably econ. My brother was a business management major. My mom raised us to run businesses and be of that mindset. And my mom was actually devastated when I told her I was leaving the business school at Lehigh because it was a great school. You know, with engineering and business majors that a lot of my friends work on Wall Street now. Anyway, and she was like, you're going to leave to become a journalism major? I'm going to send you to Lehigh to become a journalism major. And I said, Mom, first of all, I'm trying to go to the MBA. And econ it's hard. I was like, this is not an MBA major. I said, if I'm going to be really good at econ, and I'm not going to be good at basketball because I can't work out. I have, like, the hours. The work that it takes me to understand this stuff I shouldn't do it. And she didn't understand. I said, look, I'm good at writing. I'll have a useful major that I can use. I promise you that it'll be great for me because I'll be able to articulate myself in a certain manner, which you'll be proud of. I'll be able to share my story and other people's stories better. And I think it'll be able to amplify what I want to accomplish off the court anyway. I said, I can go back to school and figure out how to run a business, or I can get help. But I need to know how to move in certain rooms and be comfortable, and this will help me. And then I minored in sociology because I like to study people. So she made me write her something. She approved it, and I switched majors. And that's how I switched to journalism. And I knew that I was going to be in sports or work in sports at some point, whether I played or not. And I also knew the importance of storytelling and speaking in general, and what that would do for me in my life. So I didn't know I worked for ESPN and do all that stuff, but I knew that it was a pathway to success for me in a lot of different ways.
That's neat. And journalism's neat in that when you learn it in school, there are actual rules that come into responsible journalism that interact with creativity. And there's not a lot of professions out there that have both of those components to them, that the responsible job of reporting a story plus the ability to tell it well to people that they want to read it. I just thought that was kind of impressive.
It gives you a better appreciation of people that have to do their job, right? Like, I play a poor game, right? And they're going to ask me about it, and I have to answer them. And I get it. They're not trying to be, for lack of better words, jerks, right? They're just trying to get their job done. Some people are trying to be jerks, mm-hmm. and you figure that out very early on. But you just try to make people's jobs easier, understanding that I had to go get quotes from people. Like, I worked for Lehigh Sports. I interned. I covered games. I covered tennis, field hockey, lacrosse, women's basketball, everything but men's basketball. I covered. I wrote feature stories. I broke down film. I followed a field hockey ball, or whatever it is called, in the rain in 40-degree weather. So, like, I have a greater appreciation of the roles associated with that. So I think that's helped me strategically answer questions a certain type of way.
I read somewhere that there was a disagreement in your house. Not a disagreement. A conversation that may or may not have been settled, that you wanted a Rottweiler and a Yorkie.
That's two different extremes.
Oh, he did the research. Yes. So I grew up with Rottweilers. I wanted a Rottweiler. My wife grew up with Yorkies. She wanted a Yorkie. So I said, let's get a Rottweiler and a Yorkie. They'll become friends. And COVID ends up happening. and I'm looking for Yorkies to get her. Like, I'm like, all right, I'm going to get her a Yorkie. Like, we're going to get her a small dog. This will be great. And she's looking for a big dog for me, a Rottweiler. Aww. And we don't know it. And I come home. I think I'm starting to ramp up. Like, I started training again because I was like, I might have a season. I come home from, like, running on the track. She's like, I got good news and bad news. And I'm like, what does that mean? She's like, good news is we're getting a dog. Bad news is it's not a Rottweiler. And I was like, oh, it's going to get you a Yorkie. So, like, so what is it? What's happening? She's like, I called the dog shelter, and we're gonna foster a dog. And I was like, foster for how long? She was like, a week. I was like, okay, that's cool. I was like, well, what is it? She was like, I asked them what the biggest dog they had was coming on the truck, and they have a Bull Mastiff.
Oh, wow.
And I said, well, how big is the Bull Mastiff? She's like, well, it's a puppy. So it's not very big right now. So I'm like, okay. So we get a Bull Mastiff. She comes home, and the rest is history. We end up fosterfelling, and that's now Fiona, who's Bull Mastiff, Sharpei, Pyrenees. That's our first dog, first daughter, first kid, before our real kid. And that's how we got Fiona. She was trying to get me a Rottweiler that turned into a Bull Mastiff that we fostered, and then we ended up adopting Fiona, who's here now, and... she actually loves New Orleans. She likes
it.
I
want to meet a Fiona.
Is this dog friendly?
Yes.
For you it is. Because okay. We love dogs. Animal. We adopted two.
Two.
One is actually Rottweiler Pitbull Buster.
And
so.
We just lost him, but we had a 15-year-old Pomeranian. So we had the big dog.
We had a
dog.
Big and a small.
They get along.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And the little dog was the boss. I mean, 15 pounds versus 70. And
we'll bring Fiona or we'll go on a walk
with
our dogs.
Yeah, we love that because I love dogs. They're so loving. They know if you're sad, if you're happy.
Right.
They just want to love you.
Exactly. They are some of the better companionship that you will have. They can sense your moods. I got home last night and my dog was waiting by the door. And I'm like, do not wake mommy up. Do not wake mommy up. Of course. She wakes mommy up, jumps in the bed, sits between my legs. She's like 70 pounds. And I'm like, you can't sleep here. You're going to have to go on the floor. And I gave her 20 minutes. And I made her go back to her doggy bed.
They're the best.
It's our firstborn.
And that's the way we feel, too. But with a big dog like that, how much furniture have you lost in the last...
She was good for a while. I mean, she has a few accidents. She came... fairly trained, and then we trained her better, and then we sent her to training, which helped. I left to go to the bubble, and she had daddy issues.
Aww.
Yeah, she tore up our couch, which we ended up keeping because it was just like, we're not buying another couch. So there was chew marks all over the bottom. And
that's what we have right now, because we're just going to wait till they pass that phase, and then...
She chewed through that couch, the ottoman, the bottoms of chairs... Yeah, we had like a nice.
Shoes.
I mean, we had to sell all
you
this stuff, give away most of it, donate most of it, and we sold maybe four items. She wasn't a shoe person.
That's good.
She liked wood when she was, I don't know, like call it the teething stage, I guess, for a dog. But now we got new furniture in our home now, and she has designated, you're not allowed on any of these couches. You're allowed in this bed, and that's it. She doesn't go on our couches. She hasn't, knock on wood, destroyed any of our new furniture yet. And we got some wooden features that my wife would be not happy about.
Yeah. you gotta spray the, what's it?
The no chew, or what? It doesn't work. Don't pee here, no chew here. While she was having daddy issues when you went in the bubble, you were having your own separation issues, but made sure that you had a wine cellar with you in the bubble. Did anybody else have a wine cellar?
Melo actually had one shipped in. We were on the same team. That's how I know. A couple other guys just stored in their rooms. Just to be honest, I didn't know how long I was going to be there, but I knew that with nothing else to do but play basketball, I would need something to help me pass time and help us socialize. So we did rosé during the day.
Oh, that's nice.
Play Uno. We'd have practice, and then we'd meet at the pool. And we'd have rosé and play Uno and whatever, card games. And then we'd switch over to white Burgundy, and then we'd go to Pinot. And I was having a bunch of different Oregon wines shipped in. And then teammates and friends on other teams, they were doing California. We had, obviously, Old World, New World, combos of basically everything because we had, you know, East Coast teams, we had West Coast teams, we had guys from Europe. I think I got an Australian wine that a couple of Australian players brought me, and then it was just like, hey, you got to try this, you haven't tried this. And we just began to exchange wines, and it was really cool because that was the launch of McCallum Heritage 91 2018 Pinot Noir, because we had planned to launch in 2020, and then COVID hit, and I was like, well, I should just probably introduce the NBA to this in the bubble and just give away a bunch of wine, and we gave away 300 bottles, which wasn't great for the bottom line, but
well,
yeah, it was a good case study. Well,
you get some, yeah, it's marketing. You get some immediate feedback.
Yeah.
Are there times when guys get together and they try and impress you with big bottles of wine when it's not necessary, or is there saber rattling going on?
Not now.
Okay.
Because we're at the stage now as a league, as a whole, where we know that price doesn't necessarily equate to good wine or great wine in my eyes, and in most people's eyes now. Like, I got some great $35 bottles of wine that'll knock your socks off, you know what I mean, depending on the year and the producer. But I think we're at that stage now where we're just sharing what we like, whether it's expensive or not, which is cool in the wine community, and it's cool to see because we all have different wine journeys. We're all at different points in our wine journey. And I think now we're just so comfortable where, like, some of my teammates like rosé. Dame started with Riesling. I was like, please stop drinking Riesling. This is embarrassing. Like, try this. And then he found a Pinot that he liked. And now, like, he's like, I only want your Pinot. And I was like, well, you can't have all my Pinot. You can't have all of it, but I'll give you some bottles. But we got to that point where I think everybody in the league and just professional athletes in general are just more comfortable with just being themselves. Like, if you just like Chardonnay, then you just want Chardonnay. If you just want, you know, sparkling rosé, and that's what you, like, prefer to drink, I think we're at that stage now where, like, Larry Nance, he loves my rosé. He bought a case. I gifted him a case after he complained about him having to buy a case. And he was like, I love your rosé. I was like, well, you haven't tried my Char. He's like, your Char is good, but I love your rosé. It's just, like, what he likes. Right. Zion's like, I have to have your rosé. Trey, so like some of my teammates, they're not 21. I'm like, I can't gift it to you yet. Yeah. Sorry.
Never. Speaking of Trey, how does Trey, at his young age, become the player rep for the team?
Well, part of it is us saying, Trey, you're going to be the player rep.
Okay.
But the other part of it is him wanting to be involved and learn more about the league, what's going on in the NBA and his future. I told him all the time, I said, look, you got a bright future. You're going to, like, make a lot of money. You're going to be a great player. But you need to understand the business side of basketball. In the business side of basketball, I teach you the business side of the world because they all work similarly. And I think he's starting to understand the importance of knowing the right people, having these types of conversations, being a forward thinker. And you want to be associated and known as someone who's intelligent but uses it properly. And I think he's heading in that direction of went to Rice, went to Virginia. And I said you can't cheat in Rice or at Virginia. And you can't cheat the knowledge that you're going to learn from those types of places. And for him, it's translating well, and obviously he's playing extremely well, and more endorsements and things like that will come. But I told him, I said, you got a chance to do a lot of special things in this world, not just on the court but off the court, but you need to understand how a lot of this stuff works. I can show you so much and teach you so much, but you got to be involved to learn.
But again, that goes back to being fortunate enough to have someone, you are now that person, kind of passing that back on to them, and not being the superstar just up on your throne and only going to dinner with kings and governors and things like that.
As Tamika would say, I'm a servant leader. You got to be able to serve in order to lead.
Good way to put it.
Yeah.
The how important, I don't want to say a name, how important are veterans who don't get any playing time but they're on the bench, right? Fans don't necessarily, a casual fan wouldn't necessarily know what that position means to either chemistry.
Garrett Temple, extremely important to our team. That's my guy, and we talk very often about life, business, basketball, ethics, right from wrong. And they're extremely important to franchises, organizations, to the culture, to the team. In terms of being able to speak up, they're in the fire with you every day. They go through the same stress, the same anxiety. And his career arc and trajectory of been a starter in the league, been a role player, been a guy that doesn't play, he understands and appreciates each role, and he's not afraid to hold people accountable, and he can speak to the fact that, look, I've been on teams where I played, I've been on teams where I haven't played. If I can do it and be a good teammate, you can too. And I think the accountability is very important, but it's also the conversations that he's having with players behind closed doors that the casual fan doesn't see or doesn't hear. And it's a conversation that he can have with me where it's like, gee, what do I need to work on? How can I be better for this team to be better? What does our staff need to work on? What does this player need to work on? How do I have this conversation with this player to make sure that we're taking this step forward? And then you have the conversation of accountability behind closed doors. Like, we're all in this together. And I think especially for younger players, as a guy who was a younger player in the league, I'm at the age now where I thought this age was old when I first got into the league.
Right.
So I understand the importance of being able to go to your teammate who has a son or has a daughter or has a family. How do I balance these things? I just have this right now. How should I be structuring my days? When do I rest? When do I work out? How do I invest? What's a 401k? How do I max out my pension?
You don't have a 401k.
I do have a 401k.
I didn't mean that.
I do.
There are bigger things to worry about than your...
Exactly. And I think the cool part about having veteran leadership on your team is that they've already done what you're trying to accomplish, right? So I like told my teammates, I was like, I'm not trying to sound arrogant or anything like that, but I've been exactly where you're trying to go. I know what it's like to do it, I know it's like to not do it. I've seen both sides, and this is my 10th year in the league, and I've seen a lot of guys in this league and out this league in a hurry, and I'm trying to help you stay as long as possible.
That's really important.
And that's tough, because those are guys who were the man in high school, probably the man in college, and you think you're the man, and if you're, you know, you get up there, and there are a lot of people who are as good as you in the league.
Most of the time.
So these Uno games that y'all played, it wasn't really Uno, was it? It was Uno?
No, see, like,
how did you play Uno in the...
So
like, will you be sweet and not drop the draw
the
four on somebody?
We definitely all were cheating.
Oh, yeah.
We got to the point where we were so angry. Uno started like COVID. My wife and I played one-on-one Uno. And we'll play with friends and groups and at parties or whatever. And we're always arguing over the rules. What are the rules? Can you play multiples over top multiples? Can you do a draw four over draw four? If you're skipping, does like, and it's one-on-one, does it skip back to me?
Like,
how does this work? And got to the point where people were tweeting at Uno, like, is this rule right? My interpretation of the rule is this way. But no, we played Uno. Obviously, they're playing Bure, they're playing spades, everything. But like, Uno is very simple for me, and it's very easy, and it's straightforward, and I like to dominate. And I won a lot of Uno games. And we honestly play Uno 4 days a week minimum.
Wow.
Yeah, we were playing Uno at the pool very often.
How do you cheat at Uno? Cover your ears.
You could have colors, right? Let's say I got three twos. You could slip in a yellow. You could slip in a not a two. Oh, what's a one that looks the same? Six and a nine. You could turn it upside down. You could turn it upside down. You could do that. I mean, there's table talking you could be doing. Like, there's lots of ways that you could...
Who was the biggest cheater?
Manipulate.
You can't ask the name.
Hassan Whiteside. Hassan Whiteside. Shout out to my guy, Hassan.
That's funny. When's just the least favorite city to dine in?
Oh, no, that's not fair.
Oh, the worst. It's like, oh, you have an away game. And you're like, oh, no, we got to eat here.
Room service cities? Okay.
They're going to step that game up.
I was going to say Milwaukee, but I actually ate at Pat's house last time I was in Milwaukee. And not because the food's bad, but because the food that they have to offer isn't food that's particularly great for my diet.
Mm.
I don't eat a lot of dairy. I almost do no dairy in season besides ranch and cheeseburgers and occasional nachos. But... like brats, pizzas, like those types of things, like the things that you want to eat, but like in season's not great for me. Give you another city. I'm forgetting one. I'm from Ohio, so like saying Cleveland is like bad, but.
But it's kind of cool that for us that it used to be you would say, oh, I'm not going to, if I'm in the Midwest, I can only eat in Chicago and nowhere else has good food. Now every city has good restaurants.
Yeah.
You can find them.
Indiana. Although they got a good steakhouse
States,
in the hotel.
Yeah.
So it's like you can get something everywhere. It's just a matter of do you want to leave and is it cold and is it snowing? And that's why I call room service. Room service cities.
If you're on the road, do you, I'm guessing you eat after the game, but it's at the hotel or you like
unless,
to go out?
Unless it's an early game, we get out so late. Like, think about how hard it is for us to make a reservation in general. So unless it's a city we're accustomed to being in, where they'll keep it open for us, team caters a meal after the game where you have food post-game, and then if you want to go out to eat, you go out to eat afterwards.
What's your favorite club?
Like a nightclub?
Yeah.
I don't really go out.
You're too old for that.
It's like, I don't really go out to clubs anymore. I'm more of a lounge guy. I like good vibes, live music,
okay. Good
food. So like a good lounge city, I mean, California, Miami has a ZZ's. It's a private club where they serve food, and they got like a cigar lounge. I don't smoke cigars, but they got great whiskey, great bourbon. Sometimes there's live music. So like that's the vibe that I go for now. If I want to go to a club, I probably have to be in Vegas or in the summertime, because I'm not going to a club at this stage.
Those 2 weeks out of the year. All right. Well, CJ, thank you very much. Thank you for all you do for the city. Thank you for the excitement that you brought for this team. I don't know if you recognize it, but you coming here last year signaled a big uptick in the energy of the fan base here. We love it. We love all you do. We love that you're a fun guy to talk to. We'll see you on the court, and we'll see you in Aspen. I don't know
and
which
we'll
other.
And we'll see you in the restaurant.
And we'll see you in the restaurant.
Yeah, I'm going to be making a reservation.
We'll babysit either a dog or a child. But
perfect.
We have more experience.
We can do both.
No, I will bring the family. I don't know if we'll bring the dog with the baby, but we'll figure that out strategy-wise.
How did they get along, actually?
Very well now. Cool. Fiona stayed away for a while. She was a little awkward because she was like, what is this human that smells like you guys, looks like you guys?
Trying to steal my shine.
It's very important, and you guys give it all your attention. Now Jacoby is like stiff-arming her,
she's
like sniffing him, and she knows that like, he throws objects now, so she better get away. When he picks up something, she just goes away. But she's a protector. She protects him.
That's great.
He wants to play pro ball when he's 7 years old. What do you tell him?
Are you serious about it? I don't want to force it on him. I told my wife, he'll know how to play. I won't make him, but he will know how to play. Like, my son will know how to catch, throw, shoot, the basics. And when he says that he's ready and he's seriously ready, my brother will train him first, and then I'll train him. We have a strategy in place so that our kids don't hate us. I'm going to train his son. He's going to train mine.
Okay.
And that's how you avoid the daddy made me and I didn't want to.
So with your nephew.
He's a monster already.
At what age will you start like blocking his shot?
I'll block. When I see my nephew, I'm blocking his shot.
And he's?
Give me that.
Four?
He's two.
Oh, wow. That's not fair.
Like, I'll let him score some, but like, you got to send a message every now and then.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's also like, I'm the fun uncle. So it's like, we'll wrestle and like, we'll do all that stuff. And then I'll let him score. But my nephew counts his shots every day. He shoots. I have video of him, you know, make 10 shots in a row.
Wow.
He loves basketball because he watches it. Jacoby's third word was mama. His first. Devastating, I know. Dada. Ball. And I kind of helped him, but mom was like, how did he ball become his third word? I was like, I listen, just love basketball. I don't know.
All right, actually, one more question. Is pimping easy?
Pimping ain't easy.
Second ever Instagram post.
Oh, you did your
from
research.
From CJ McCollum. I think it's cool. Here's one other thing that we can talk about is that you're at that perfect age where Instagram started and everybody can go back and scroll back and see you grow as a young man and into the man that you are today, but that history is there and it's one of those fun things. I'm not sure which dish that was, but it looks like it was there's Haitian dressing in one of the pictures, but his first couple of pictures were food.
I love food. It's crazy. And it's funny you mentioned that because I still remember I took the sociology of hip-hop culture at Lehigh. So it related sociology to music and the crack epidemic. So there were parallels between music in the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and the influences of music and drugs on our culture and the population, and how that in turn created certain types of music. Mm-hmm. And Pimpin' Ain't Easy was the article I had to read for sociology of hip-hop culture.
The other, do you ever think how fortunate you are that you weren't born 10 years earlier and had the draft day suits that were like down to the knee, like the Steve Harvey suit?
I'm just thankful that I was able to play in an era in which the finances of sports is at an all-time high. And 10 years from now, it'll look completely different, 20 years from now. Right. But I'm glad my mom and dad conceived me when they did. The timing was very good. And in 20 years, it'll be better. But I'll be old and I'll be watching
yeah.
and laughing.
But yeah, but that's also the weight of the crown you wear now as president of the
Grow the Pie.
Players Association. That's right.
Got to grow the pie.
Well, thank you very much, CJ.
No problem.
It's a pleasure chatting with you. Look forward to
seeing you around town.
I'll see you guys before Aspen. I'm coming to the restaurant. We're going to carve out a date night. I got an off day coming up. We're coming here. We're going to eat here. Chef Joy, who's our chef who traveled with us, she's excited to see you again. And I told her, she's like, you have to eat at the restaurant. It's very good. I was like, we ate at one of them. We haven't ate the other one yet. So I will. We'll do a trip. We'll bring Chef Joy. She has a dog named Biscuit.
Aww.
And we probably won't bring all our dogs here because that'll be a mess, but we'll do a walk or something.
Yeah. All right, cool. Thank you very much, CJ.
No problem. Thank you guys. Make way for the Reaper, y'all. Yeah. Make way for the Reaper. Yeah, Bill! Make way for the Reaper. Make way for the Reaper. Make way for the Reaper. Back up. Everybody back up. Give us a rock. Give us a rock.